Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymere Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymere.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at Graymere Church of Christ.
In learning on Sunday evening, it's the wording taken from one of the Psalms describing the protection of God around His people. And that song is Surround Us, Lord, and that's been a good one for us to learn. We'll say that we missed being away from you this morning, although we enjoyed our time at the Walnut Street Church of Christ in Dixon, Tennessee. I know that there are several connections there with family members and friends of Graymere that attend there, and so it was really neat to get to meet so many people. And, of course, they were excited about Chris and Aaron Webb coming our way. Aaron grew up there, and Chris interned there. And, you know, I tried to get some really good stories on Chris from his interning days, but they wouldn't give them to me. But we're really excited to make that connection, and we're glad to have that chance to do that. I know you were blessed to hear John this morning. I look forward to listening to that recording. Let's sing this song together, and as we do, we'll sing it through twice and then repeat the chorus. As the mountains surround Jerusalem, so the Lord surrounds His people. As the mountains surround Jerusalem, so the Lord surrounds His people. Surround us, Lord. Surround us, O Lord. We need to be in Your presence. As the mountains surround Jerusalem, so the Lord surrounds His people. As the mountains surround Jerusalem, so the Lord surrounds His people. Surround us, Lord. Surround us, O Lord. We need to be in Your presence. Surround us, Lord. Continue to sing that song together. If you would turn to John chapter 18, we're going to spend a few moments looking at a trial in various Gospels, but we're going to be looking at a lot of verses out of John chapter 18. And what I'd like for us to reflect on for a few minutes this evening is the fact that when Jesus stood on trial, He stood on trial alone. It's interesting that our society is more connected probably than ever before, and yet loneliness is still an epidemic that Americans deal with. We're so connected with each other that if you wanted to get someone's attention, you could either drive by that person's house and call them, or and knock on the door. You could call them on the phone. You could try to call their cell phone. You could send them an email. You could try to leave a message for them on Facebook or on Twitter. And we have so many different ways of getting in touch with people, but we're still struggling with loneliness and feeling alone. Even though we can communicate in a lot of different ways, it doesn't seem like we're growing our relationships quite as well as we should, and loneliness is still a struggle. It was interesting that a study done by the American Council of Life Insurance a few years ago, they reported that the most lonely group in America, if you had to guess what the most lonely group in America was, what would you guess? The loneliest group they came up with were college students. And that makes sense, being out in life on your own. But at various stages in life, we face that struggle of feeling alone, feeling loneliness, like we don't really have anyone that we can turn to or that we can identify with. There's an old story that Charles Swindoll used to tell about an individual who ran an ad in a Kansas newspaper that said, "I will listen to you talk for 30 minutes without a comment for $5. That sounds like a pretty good deal, I guess, if you have a lot to say. And as the story went, he said that person soon began to receive several calls a week. People were desperate just to have someone who would listen to them. I don't know whether that's true or not, or if that's just a story that he told. But I do believe it, don't you? We want someone to listen to us. We struggle to reach out to others. And it's important for us to understand when we think about Jesus and His life as He comes to earth, that He identifies with us in every way. And we see very clearly in His trial that He faced that alone. If we want to talk about loneliness, we want to think about what loneliness feels like, Jesus understands what that is. Now just imagine for a moment what a trial would be like. Let's picture that you walk into a courtroom and you've got this courtroom that has been assembled with all of these people. You've got a jury over in a jury box. You've got the two attorneys. You've got people that are sitting and watching, and the judge is sitting up in his seat. And as you are going through this trial, you start to realize something. You realize that all the witnesses have been paid off by somebody. You're hearing them say things that were taken out of context. You're hearing them make accusations that aren't true. And you realize who's behind it. You realize that there's a prosecuting attorney that's behind getting those witnesses against you. And when you look over on your side of the table, you don't have a defense attorney. You don't have anyone who's willing to stand up for you. And the judge and the jury and the lawyer and the witnesses all agree what needs to happen to you, and you haven't even had a chance to be defended. That doesn't seem like a very fair trial, does it? When we think about the trial that Jesus experienced, we need to realize it was a trial in name only. It really wasn't a trial. It really didn't go by the established norms for trials in that time period. What it was a mockery of a trial. And yet Jesus endured it alone. And so we begin in John chapter 18, understanding that Jesus is here in the garden, and we'll look at several passages of Scripture, and many of them will be on the screen, some of them won't. I hope you have your Bibles out as we look through and trace these steps of Jesus in the trial. So here he is in verse 1. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went forth with his disciples over the ravine of the Kidron, where there was a garden in which he entered with his disciples. Now Judas also, who was betraying him, knew the place, for Jesus had often met there with his disciples. Judas then, having received the Roman cohort and officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, came there with lanterns and torches and weapons. Now let's pause there for just a moment. When we're here in the garden, John gives us some important details about what's taking place. And one of the details that he gives us is that when Judas came to betray Jesus, he came with reinforcements. Now we see a phrase here, the Roman cohort. Your translation might say a squad or a squadron. We know from what history tells us that a Roman cohort normally indicated a force of 600 Roman soldiers. Now remember, this is at night. Is it likely that all 600 of the soldiers of the Roman cohort were there? I think it'd be tough to fit 600 soldiers in this garden, and the chances that they're all there might not be very likely, but we see from the text there definitely were more than just one or two. It was more than just a handful. It was evidently a contingent of these Roman soldiers. It might be a little like when we say we're going to call the police department or the fire department. It doesn't necessarily mean that every member of the police department or the fire department will be there, but they'll be responsible for it. Judas wasn't coming just on his own authority. He had these Roman soldiers, and I believe there were quite a few. There might not have been the full 600, but I think we see quite a few soldiers come to arrest one man. Just stop and think about that for a moment. One man. And they were going to have so many people there involved, not just by themselves, but did you notice what they were carrying? They had lanterns and torches. Well, that makes sense. It's the middle of the night. And they also had weapons. One man, a lot of soldiers, but they were worried about what might take place. And so they come there in verse 4, Jesus, knowing all the things that were coming upon him. John makes sure to let us know that none of this was a surprise to Jesus. He went forth and said, "Whom do you seek?" They answered him, "Jesus the Nazarene." He said to them, "I am he." And Judas also, who was betraying him, was standing with them. So when he said to them, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. Again, let's pause here for just a moment. Roman soldiers would not have been very skittish individuals. These would have been individuals that were used to keeping the peace. They were used to dealing with conflict. And so they're here in the garden, and however many there might have been that are seeking to arrest Jesus, when Jesus says, "I am he," you have them falling backwards. And it's really hard for us to picture exactly what took place. Some have said just simply the power of Jesus' voice or something about the way Jesus said it miraculously pushes them back as if they're just in shock from what he's saying. Well, that may have happened. It seems to me like what happened is they're here to arrest this man they're obviously afraid of because they brought weapons. They've heard what he's done. They've heard that he's raised the dead. They've heard that he's performed miracles. They've heard about what happened in John chapter 8 when the people tried to stone him and Jesus passed through them and they didn't catch him. People have tried to kill him before and he's eluded them. And when he says, "I am he," and they find out that's who Jesus is, I think we almost get a picture of them stumbling backwards over themselves because they're scared. There's something about Jesus that they realize is powerful. And whatever the case, when he reveals who he is, these Roman soldiers draw back. They fall back. And so in verse 7, "Therefore he again asked them, 'Whom do you seek?' And they said, 'Jesus the Nazarene.' Jesus answered, 'I told you that I am he. So if you seek me, let these go their way, to fulfill the word which he spoke.'" And that's back in John 17, verse 12, when he said, "Of those whom you have given me, I have not lost one." Jesus went through the trial alone, and part of that was due to his choice. He was protecting his disciples. And so when Peter draws a sword and he strikes the high priest's slave, Malchus, and cuts off his right ear, Jesus makes it very clear that that's not what's happening. We're not taking up weapons. Now you can imagine from Peter's perspective, this starts to seem more like an earthly Messiah taking power, a face-off with Roman soldiers. I mean, this feels like what many of the Jews were thinking about when they were looking for that Messiah that would give them political independence from Rome. And so Peter is ready to go. He's already pledged that he's going to be faithful to Jesus. And so he takes this sword and he swipes at this high priest's slave, cuts off his ear, and yet Jesus heals it. Because what Jesus is going to do is different than what Peter expects. Jesus goes through this trial alone. Part of that was him protecting his disciples. But we also see when we start comparing the gospel accounts that part of that was due to the apostles' fear. Matthew 26 and 56 tells us the disciples fled. In other words, they were trying to get away from that scene. They saw what happened with those soldiers and their weapons. We'll later see Peter deny even knowing who Jesus is, deny any association with him, and to do so very vehemently. We understand that some of that was due to Jesus' protection, and some of that was due to the apostles' fear. Jesus goes on trial alone. I mentioned earlier this was a mockery of a trial, and there are several things that we know about the judicial system at the time. Some of those things we know from Jewish writings from years later, and so you have to project that maybe some of those things were being practiced in Jesus' day. But it becomes very clear that they weren't concerned about the trial moving along the way a trial should. They were concerned about taking care of this problem that had arisen with this popular teacher. And so they had this trial conducted at night. That was something that was illegal. You weren't supposed to do that at night. To have someone arrested and put on trial at that very hour of the night was not something that was usually done. And they didn't take him directly to the high priest. They took him instead to Annas, the father-in-law of the high priest. And we see that as we continue looking at various passages. We see Jesus go before him in John 18 and verse 12. The Roman cohort and the commander and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him and led him to Annas first, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. Now that may seem a little strange to us. Why wouldn't you just take him directly to Caiaphas? Why would you take him to Annas first? But if we understand the circumstances, Caiaphas was the high priest that year, but Annas had previously served as high priest. Now, he was removed from office, but as we know from Jewish tradition and Jewish law, that they considered a high priest kind of a lifetime appointment. And so Valerius Gratus had removed Annas and had put his son-in-law in place, but in many ways, Annas still has this incredible influence. And so they go to him first, and they take Jesus before him, and you have this this showdown here when the high priest begins questioning Jesus about his disciples and about his teaching. And Jesus says, "I've spoken openly to the world. I always taught in the synagogues and the temples." In other words, he's saying, you had just as much right as anyone else to listen to what I was saying. There's nothing I've done that was secret. Verse 21, he would say, "Why do you question me? Question those who heard what I spoke to them. They know what I said." When he said this, one of the officers nearby struck Jesus, saying, "Is that the way you answer the high priest?" And so here Jesus is on trial, and he's already being hit by those who are putting him on trial. It doesn't seem like a fair trial. Even when he responds, he's struck by a soldier. So as he's led before Annas after this, when Jesus questions it in verse 23, "I've spoken wrongly, testify of the wrong, but if rightly, why do you strike me?" So then they bind him up and send him to Caiaphas. So in his trial, he's had to stand alone before Annas. And he said openly, "Here's what I've done, here's what I've taught, ask people who've listened to me if you want to know." And instead, he gets hit and bound and taken to Caiaphas, the acting high priest of that time. Now, as we look at John's account, John doesn't give us details of what happens with Caiaphas, but Matthew does. In Matthew 26, the chief priests and the whole council kept trying to obtain false testimony against Jesus so that they might put him to death. Again, this is not a real trial. In a real trial, you wouldn't have people blatantly trying to get false witnesses to testify so that you could go ahead and give the death sentence. That's not a trial that's really giving someone a fair chance. But notice what happens in verse 60. They did not find any, even though many false witnesses came forward. But later on, two came forward, and one said, "This man stated, 'I am able to destroy the temple and to rebuild it in 3 days.'" As they're struggling with these witnesses' testimonies, we remember the Jewish law that something had to be established on the testimony of two or more people. It wasn't just enough for one person to be able to make a statement. That had to be corroborated by something else. And they're searching for two people who can get on the same page with false testimony against Jesus, and they have trouble finding it. They have trouble finding false witnesses that can agree long enough to say something that would be incriminating to Jesus. This is fascinating as this process is going forward. And so Jesus is standing there, and finally they have someone who comes forward and twists something that we read Jesus say in John 2 and verse 19 when he's talking about his body. And he says, "Destroy this temple and I will rebuild it in 3 days." And so now they're saying he's claiming to destroy the temple. And that was the strategy. If they could just accuse him of that, the temple was so important in Jewish life that that would be a serious reason for punishment. And as they're struggling through all of this, the high priest stands up and says to Jesus, "Do you not answer?" Jesus is quiet. You have all of these individuals that are seeking to put together some kind of corroborating testimony, and Jesus is quiet the entire time, and finally Caiaphas can't handle it anymore. And he says, "What is it these men are testifying against you?" Verse 63, but Jesus kept silent. And the high priest said to him, "I adjure you by the living God that you tell us whether you are the Christ, the Son of God." Well, let's just think about this for a moment. Isn't the best strategy at this point, if you were in that place and you have false witnesses that can't even agree with one another, wouldn't the best strategy be just to stay quiet? After all, if you stay quiet, then surely they're going to have a hard time finding someone to accuse you. But Jesus doesn't do what we might think would be the best human strategy. Jesus knows where this is leading. He knows what is happening. And as we'll see later, he's in control of the whole process. And so when Caiaphas makes this statement to him, adjuring him, it's almost like he's putting him under oath. Jesus responds very powerfully by saying, "You have said it yourself, the question, 'Are you the Christ, the Son of God?' Nevertheless, I tell you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven." Here he is before the high priest, and he's using this imagery of the Son of Man from Daniel chapter 7. This idea of a kingdom that will never be destroyed. and that He is the Son of Man. And so obviously, that gives them just the motivation they need to seek to put Him to death. The high priest tears his robes in verse 65 and says, "He is blasphemed. What further need do we have of witnesses?" It's a good thing we don't have to try to get two witnesses to agree anymore. We don't need them. He's just claimed to be the Son of Man. And so then He is led to before Pilate. Now that's been the Jewish religious system trying Him. Now He's led before Pilate. And Pilate summons Jesus and says to Him, "Are you the King of the Jews?" Now notice the difference. When Pilate uses the term King of the Jews, I don't think he means exactly what the Jews would have understood that to mean. In other words, he says clearly here in verse 35, "I am not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and the chief priests delivered you to me. What have you done?" He doesn't seem to fully understand why they're so upset with Jesus, but he understands terms of power, and he understands what it means to be the king. And that's his question. Are you the king? Are you a king? Are you claiming to be a ruler? That's the phrase that keeps popping up in his correspondence, in his discussion with Jesus. Are you the king? Are you claiming to be in charge? And notice how Jesus responds in verse 36. He says, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting." And what had he just done in the garden? He had stopped Peter from fighting, "so that I would not be handed over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm." Then Pilate said to him, "So you are a king." Now remember, in John's gospel, you have all of these exchanges with people like the woman at the well or the man who was born blind, where Jesus is speaking on a spiritual plane and they're thinking on a physical plane. Whether it's the living water that they're talking about or the blindness that Jesus speaks about in John chapter 9. So here Jesus is talking about being a spiritual king, and Pilate says, okay, so you are a king, right? I understand that language. You are a king. And then Jesus says, "You say correctly, I'm a king. For this I have been born, and for this I've come into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." And Pilate says to him, "What is truth?" And when he had said this, he went out again to the Jews and said to them, "I find no guilt in him." As I read this, I can't help imagining Pilate being very concerned about the political ramifications of someone claiming to be a king. And he's asked Jesus, "Are you the king of the Jews?" But his response is Jesus saying that he's not a physical king whose servants are going to fight. And as Pilate discovers that, it seems to me that Pilate doesn't see Jesus as a real threat. I have to imagine that if Pilate perceived Jesus was a threat, he would have gone ahead and had him put to death without really the reluctance we see. But he can't find anything against him. And so then he sends him to Herod. And so Jesus goes before Herod. We see this in Luke's account in Luke 23. Now Herod was very glad when he saw Jesus. He'd wanted to see him for a long time. He'd been hearing about him and wanted to see a sign that was performed. He questioned them, but he answered him nothing. And you have the chief priests and the scribes that are standing there, and they all begin to treat Jesus with contempt. And all this ends up doing is making Herod and Pilate friends when they'd once been enemies. Now, there was a time when Herod heard about Jesus, and Herod was afraid of Jesus. In fact, there was a time when Herod thought about what Jesus was doing and saw what he was doing, he was suspicious that it was John the Baptist. In fact, in Luke 13:31, some Pharisees warned Jesus that Herod wanted to kill him. And so apparently there was rumors going around when Jesus started doing miraculous things, "This is John the Baptist come back from the dead." And that would have scared Herod, because Herod would have been the one who put him to death. But by the time we get to this point, Herod doesn't see Jesus as a threat either. Not a physical threat to his authority. And so he really treats him like a joke. He kind of makes a sport of him and sends him back to Pilate. Through every step of this trial, Jesus has been alone. And it's a reminder to us that at various points, Jesus could have chosen to remove himself from the situation. Even when he goes to Pilate after this, he would say, "You have no authority except what has been given to you from above." He didn't have to endure what he endured, but in order to save us, he chose not to save himself. If Jesus would have saved himself, he wouldn't have saved us. Jesus could have saved himself very easily at any point, but he goes through this alone, and he suffers this alone, and the very people that are hurling abuse on him, and the very people that are crying out for him to be crucified, are the ones who will be able to have salvation, because Jesus has made the choice not to save himself. He alone is the one who can save. And so as he alone goes through this trial, we realize that the reason he's going through this, the reason he doesn't save himself, is so that we can be saved. And he alone had the authority. That's what's really fascinating to me about this whole trial, is because when the Jewish leaders saw Jesus, they understood that he was teaching like someone with authority. At the end of the Sermon on the Mount, at the end of Matthew chapter 7, that's what amazed the people, that he taught as one with authority. It wasn't a scribe or a Pharisee that was referring to all these different rabbis. He was teaching like he had the authority. In Jesus' ministry, he claimed the authority to be able to forgive sins. And when he raised Lazarus from the dead in John 11, that's when we see a group of chief priests convene and say there's got to be something that's done about him. In fact, specifically, we find out that they're concerned in verses 47 through 50, that in verse 48, they're worried all would believe in him and that the Romans would take away their place in their nation. If everyone believes in him, we're not going to be the leaders anymore. We're not going to have the place that we have right now. We want to maintain the status quo. They understood that Jesus had authority and that threatened their way of life. But you know what's interesting? That Pilate and Herod don't seem to understand that. They seem to be puzzled with why this is such a big deal. It reminds me of what Paul would write to the church at Corinth when he described the cross of Christ, that to the Jews it was a stumbling block and to the Gentiles it was foolishness. It seems like foolishness to Pilate and to Herod. Now later on, we're going to find out, if we look at all the gospel accounts, that Pilate starts to get bothered by the fact that they want Jesus put to death so badly. The fact that even though he offers for them to have another prisoner released, they choose Barabbas. And his wife will come to him with a dream he's had. And he does get concerned. And so he tries to wash his hands of the whole thing. But even then, he doesn't have that true understanding of the authority that Jesus has. It's a reminder to me that no matter what the setting is, and no matter who we might think is in power, there's only one that has true authority. Jesus had authority. In fact, he should still have authority over my life today. And that's not a popular word. It's not a popular thought or a popular idea. And yet, we see the authority very clearly. You have to imagine that Herod, Antipas, when he goes before Herod, surely if Herod thought he was some kind of threat to the throne, he would have had him taken care of. Remember, Herod's father, Herod the Great, we're introduced to at the beginning of Jesus' life. In fact, when Jesus is born, Matthew 2 tells us about these magi that are going to see him. And Herod the Great finds out about it and finds out they're going to see him because you have this king of the Jews who's going to be born. And Herod tries to trick them into giving away that location. And then he'll slaughter children. He'll slaughter infant males of Bethlehem and the surrounding areas just to try to eliminate this threat. Historically, Herod the Great was famous for being suspicious of family members and friends who were trying to take the throne. And wouldn't you think that Herod Antipas, if he really thought someone was a threat, would have had him eliminated? But Herod and Pilate don't seem to understand. In fact, no one really seems to understand what's taking place. And so Herod just makes sport of him and sends him back to Pilate. Pilate just tries to wash his hands of it, situation, and keep the people happy. But no matter who's involved, Annas, Caiaphas, Pilate, or Herod, in the end, Jesus is the one who is in control. He has the authority. He has an authority that Herod could never imagine. Herod probably felt pretty good about himself when he makes sport of Jesus and speaks contemptuously of Jesus, but Jesus had authority he couldn't understand. Pilate tried to throw his weight around and throw his authority around, but Jesus had authority Pilate could never understand. Annas and Caiaphas might have felt good about the fact that they had influence, but Jesus had a different kind of authority. And so I need to ask myself if my life is being ruled by his authority. You may have heard recently about the Brooklyn Free School, an innovative approach to education. It's interesting to read about this school whose students decide on the rules of the school. There are about 50 students, ages 9 to 19, and they govern themselves. Any student can call a student body meeting to vote on any issue. They decide disciplinary matters, at what age students should receive what kind of privileges. They set their own study pace. They do have teachers and adults present, but the adults are outnumbered 3 to 1 by kids, so they can outvote them. Every graduate of the school has been able to get into college and academically successful. It's made news because of its innovative strategy, and I think it's interesting to hear about a school like this. It's modeled after the way our government works, the theory being that the majority will make the right decision. And that's an interesting way to run a school, I suppose. I don't have much experience with it. It'd be fascinating to see how some of those things worked out. I think it's a good way for us to run the government, majority rule. But you know, when it comes to following God, that's not the way it works. When it comes to following God, I submit to His authority. Like it or not, I don't get to have a vote. Because as a Christian, I'm wanting to serve God, and God sets the agenda on how I live. And it's so easy to become accustomed to a world where I think about all the rights that I have and all the privileges that I deserve. But when I serve God as a Christian, He has to have the authority over my life. When Jesus stood on trial alone, He had all the authority, and yet He was willing to go through all of that in order to save us. As we think about these two aspects of Jesus being alone on trial and yet alone having authority that none could understand, I think we can appreciate an answer to our loneliness that we struggle with. When we feel alone, when we feel like there's no one else that we can turn to, that we can reach out to, I think we see a picture here of Jesus who understands what it means to be left alone. What it means to have the friends that had been so close to you flee to get away from those who were taking you captive. What it means to be beaten and mistreated in a way that is gruesome to imagine as we think about the crucifixion. To be led through this sort of mockery of a trial that is totally unfair. Everything about the situation is unfair. And yet Jesus proceeds with it. Because in order to save us, He chose not to save Himself physically on the cross. And dying that death and rising from the grave, He gives us the opportunity to be saved. He alone stood on trial. He alone had the authority. And He alone can save us. There is no other name by which we can be saved. It's powerful to think about Jesus standing on trial. It's powerful to think about the way He identifies with us and our weakness and our brokenness and our loneliness. But it's even more encouraging to realize that we can be saved through Him. And tonight, if you need to make that a reality in your life, if you need to turn to Christ, if you need to turn your life around, confess Jesus as Lord, put Him on in baptism, you can begin walking that life that can identify with the Savior who is willing to come to earth and to die for you. Or it may be that you've done that and there are other issues in your life, areas over which Jesus needs to be your authority. If there's any way we can help you, please come as we stand, as we sing together.